3, 2, 1. Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Authority Smashing Hour with your hosts, Luke Jim and Mr. 1001 Nights. Join us as we embark on a journey through radical news and politics, take calls, and get you ready to engage in the struggle against capitalism.
Hello, everyone, and welcome once again to the Authority Smashing Hour, one of the best anarchist shows on the internet. Yes, and I say that without regret because we've been going at it for a few months now, and it's going pretty strong. We just started hosting the show every day of the week, which I don't know if we can maintain, but we'll try for a while. We should have it on Mondays only, but we're trying to do it for a little bit longer now. So, and our friend Buddha Jam was supposed to be here, but I don't know what's going on. I guess he's busy doing other stuff or some other priorities, I guess. So instead, we have our friend Charnchi, who is one of the production people here, takes care of the website, and he just uploaded a new picture of all the people that are going to be hosting the show during the week. Are you there, Charnchi?
Hey, Jonathan. How you doing?
Pretty good, man.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Yeah, I think David's out with his lady.
Oh, so that's what I figured.
I couldn't get a hold of him, but we'll have him on again. Probably Monday.
That's okay, because you know, it can be anarchism, it can be love. if you do any of those two things, I think you're doing okay, right? I think David
good for
is
him, man.
David is he's a good guy, and he appears to be a ladies' man as well, so all the power to him.
And free spirit and everything.
So also, I'm here in San Francisco. They just started the training for the Blue Angels, which are the exhibition of aircraft, and they're a real pain in the ass. I mean, they make so much noise. They fly really low. Some years ago, they had an accident and crashed into some building, and somebody died. I mean, but it's just terrible. I did an interview. I did a video with interviews asking people what they thought about it, and a lot of people were not happy. Do you guys have something like that in Boston, where aircraft fly around the city and stuff, or no?
I haven't seen any. I've been here 4 years, so I should know. But we have, it's Boston Harbor, so we have, Fleet Week or something. Tall ships, will come in for a week. But
that's what it is.
We haven't had
Fleet Week. I think it's called Fleet Week here, too.
Yeah, but I haven't seen any planes.
It's a pain in the ass. And the funny thing is that when I asked people about whether or not they thought it was a militaristic display, a display of military power, I'd say, I don't see it that way. But see, the methods of legitimizing the imperialism and military power are pretty subtle, and people don't see them as such. But, I was just thinking about it once again. It's so obvious, but I was reading Time magazine, and for the latest issue, they have this picture on the front, and the intimate lives of soldiers, and they show pictures of them, and so we, whether we agree with the mission or not, we sort of we identify ourselves with them. They're like us, and they're one of us. But see, they don't show, for example, pictures of and stories about the resistance in Iraq or the resistance in Afghanistan or, it's people. And that way we have a face. The military has a face, but they don't have a face. So if you kill them, it's okay. But, but nobody would say, this is a biased story. It would say, no, we're just covering the military lives and stuff. But if you think about it, and of course, if you add to that the stories, the news stories that we hear all the time, the Hollywood all the films where U.S. soldiers do all these wonderful things and fight for freedom, and you sort of feel identified with that group. So, yeah,
it's one of the oldest propaganda techniques, I guess, to dehumanize your quote unquote enemies and humanize your own, you know, killers. It goes way back, you know, like. I'm sure, like, ancient Chinese writings have stuff like that, too. But, yeah.
And I guess it translates into other areas as well, like, for example, interracial relations. I guess, you being Chinese, of Chinese descent, you have experienced how the Chinese have been portrayed in a certain way, which was not always honest, wasn't, What has been your experience with that?
I think with the Chinese, the Asian community in general, like, it's kind of subtle. In a way, we're kind of accepted as, you know, the exotic, you know, for female leads, they're considered exotic and sexy and all this stuff, mysterious. But for the Asian male, it's like, you know, they're nerds or they're kung fu masters or something like that. And, you know, there's been complaints about that. I sort of feel like, you know, it's Hollywood, you know? It's kind of infuriating, but, you know, what I don't really pay attention to all that stuff. I'd rather focus on the real issues.
Right. Well, maybe another question. Go ahead.
Well, I was gonna say, like, most of the kind of the discrimination I've felt, it's more like, you know, it's really subtle. Like in the city of Boston, it's very segregated. So, like, a lot of the Asian people, you know, they're segregated in schools, and you know, the different colleges here, and a lot of them are, you know, assimilated, but, like, so if I'm not assimilated, you know, then I'll be looked at it differently.
I guess that, you know, another question in that respect is sort of related to a video we did when we went to Boston and we were preparing to film Ferguson, and that was we asked you about the Asian coordinator class and how that's a sort of cultural expectation. And you know, I wonder to what extent that has become part of the culture, that when you look at a Chinese or an Asian person, you immediately are predisposed to think that they're very likely part of that coordinator class, that they're smart in a sort of narrow way, in a managerial way. Do you feel that has become part of the culture?
I mean, the culture is broad, but I think the specific Asian American culture, I would have to say yes, because you know, most of the people that came over here are, you know, of certain social class, and they're taught to, you know, be like, become one of these managers. You know, social managers of certain kind, like corporate managers, doctors, lawyers. And yes, there's a social pressure, you know, pushing, you know, each one of us towards that. I was lucky enough that I was not part of it. My background is a little different.
Yeah, I guess maybe you can explain a little more what is meant by the Asian coordinator class, because a lot of people, I guess, and the audience may not know what you mean by that.
Well, it's kind of like a Mandarin class. You know, the word came from the Manchurian dynasties in China, which is basically, you know, people who are going to uphold power. And they could come from the poorest, you know, sectors of the population, but once, you know, they exhibit, like, skills of one kind or the other, technical skills or, you know, whatever scientific things, and they're enticed to, you know, enter and become basically a gatekeeper. you know, and it's kind of ingrained in this kind of upper middle class Asian culture, you know. But you, like back in China, well, back in the old country, you know, you still have poor peasants and, you know, workers who have other values, you know.
Well, of course,
but
in
I
fact,
think
yeah, they're saying that in fact, in China, most people are not upper middle class coordinators. Most Chinese people are, you know, are working class, and they're horribly exploited, by the way.
Yeah, I think the number is something like 850 million peasants. Excuse me, go ahead. I have to go for a second. I'm still working right now.
Okay, so, all right.
Yeah, take over.
All right. So, yeah, I mean, that's pretty interesting, and I guess I was going to ask Charnchi about one thing that we always hear is kind of a racist comment that always pits one minority against the other. So when people seek to say that blacks are inherently a certain way, that, you know, inherently thuggish or whatever, they always say, look, you can't say that that's because of their past, because look at the Chinese. The Chinese were always enslaved, but look at them now. Now they're good people. And why are they good people? Because they're, you know, we have this idea of them as the coordinators or the good workers, the worker bees, you know, that will serve the system. And so it's kind of a very skewed view of the world, and misunderstands the role of cultural influence in, you know, in the in our society. So yeah, like as I was saying, the Blue Angels are in San Francisco, and it's boy, it's like every, you guys probably don't hear it, but every about 10 minutes I hear the aircraft flying by, and it bugs the hell out of me. I hate that stuff. And you know, as I was telling Charchi, last year I did a video, and all these people were telling me that their dogs were twitching and just terrified of this noise. It's really annoying. And I mean, just think about it. I mean, it sort of gives you a little reminder. How would it be like if you were in Iraq getting bombed by one of these things?
Depending on the lights, it'll tell me what the problem is. When you turn it up.
Anyway, so we could hear Charging in the background. Okay, let me turn off that stuff. So anyway, let's get to some important news here. I recommend everyone to go to an article. This is a great article that was just posted on infoshop.org, and I'm gonna post the link on the chat room, and I suggest all of you guys go and check it out. Wait a second. Yeah, I think somebody, I think my friend Chomskin already posted it. Yeah, it basically talks about it's a full report of the G20 mobilization. And I haven't read the whole thing yet. I was just sort of browsing through it. But apparently, it was significantly successful. At first, you know, when people compared some of the more mature or quote-unquote more developed anarchist movements in Europe, you know, like Greece, you know, it doesn't look as strong. But, you know, for American standards, this was pretty damn powerful. And it succeeded at many levels. And they sort of, they give a pretty pretty thorough a pretty thorough description of what happened from every angle. I haven't yet read the chapter on police tactics and strategy, though we do know the massive police presence there. And basically what they're saying here is that they embarrass themselves, the cops embarrass themselves. And, you know, and that's the thing, that we when we go to these demonstrations, we, you know, the importance of the cameras too is to shed light on some of the abuses, police brutality, and and basically the police state that arises when real challenges to power take place. And that's what, so why it's so, in some ways, it's very good that you have all these cameras around, because that encourages people. It really, you know, my opinion is it comes to collective consciousness. That's what these demonstrations are about. That's, it's sort of to try to spark a little bit of fire, you know, and bring and allow people to think about these things, to start to question some of the some of the assumptions of our system. And I think that in this particular case it succeeded. A lot of people started thinking about what's behind the system we're in. I mean, because the corporate media were actually saying the opposite of the truth. They were saying, "Oh well, our city's not really like this. These are just these evil demonstrators, who, you know, these agitators." That, but the truth is that we are seeing the real beast. You see, when we start challenging power, then they show what they're really all about. And that's what we saw in Pittsburgh. and of course they arrested a bunch of people, and they try to level bogus charges against them. But it turns out that the police failed on many levels. And as far as the last chapter, which talks about room for improvement. And, you know, it basically comes down to reaching out to the community in more different ways, and in more original ways, and just basically expanding what they're already doing, and devising new ways to bring new allies to the activist movement. What was also worth noting is that a lot of these anarchists, who, according to the report, were only about 1,000, they were supported by other people from different political leanings, and that's important, because we see our role is not to simply do our thing and forget about everyone else. We have to radicalize everyone. The anarchists are they should be the quote-unquote leaders in the sense that they take the initiative in radicalizing people and rejecting the hierarchical status quo, okay? So they're taking the initiative in challenging authority and doing all the and taking it to the next level. That's what the role of the anarchist should be, and in fact, we know that throughout history, that has been their role, and that's why we should learn from this particular experience. And apparently, it has encouraged just, you know, thousands of people to go to the next demonstration and just get more involved, because people were pretty terrified. Oh God, all these cops and all, but people realize, hey, you know, this is not. It's not as bad as I thought it was. You know, you can actually go out there. You can do things. You're not going to get murdered out there. So you have a chance to change things, man. So let's get out there and do something when we get a chance. On another note, you know, it was kind of interesting because I did a video the other day about a gift economy, and I basically just got some information of David Graeber, one of his articles on gift economies. And as I was posting it, and then I posted it, and then I saw another video from, you know, right here in San Francisco of you guys have probably heard about something called the Really Really Free Market, which is basically every month they have a gathering where people bring stuff and people just it's totally free. You can just get anything you want, and it's called the Really Really Free Market, and it's sort of a gift economy at the end of the month. And there was this girl that was organizing it, and I forget her name now. I can't remember, but they had a video from her in 2008, and apparently she was murdered. She was murdered, and they don't even know who did it and why it was done. But she was murdered in some in New Orleans, you know, like last year. So I thought, wow, that's pretty. Pretty shocking news that someone from that, you know, particular movement was murdered like that. But yeah, this girl, she was basically talking about how he was, you know, talking about a gift economy and all the advantages it had, and the myth of scarcity, and how you know, we, it's amazing, like the more we have, you know, like the average human now has much more material stuff than you know, anybody could have imagined even like 100 years ago. Yet, you know, we're more and more paranoid about, oh, you know, my stuff, let's not share, let's, you know, gather more and more material stuff for ourselves. And, you know, there's so much room for sharing. And it's, you know, of course it's impossible to achieve a gift economy, in 2 minutes. It's something that takes a psychological, change. It takes a spiritual change. And so what I did in my video is basically spell out some of the, ways in which people in the past have achieved such societies. And I talk about, of course, I mention how David Graeber talks about indigenous societies who had gift economies, but I also talk about some of the villages in anarchist Spain, which did have these sort of gift economies, and you know, basically had community stores where everyone could get whatever they wanted, and I mean that would be a real world, a real humane world right there. But of course, we don't even need to get to that point to have a world that is sustainable, I don't think. I think that even an anarcho-syndicalist society, even a society that you know, does not have the sort of wastage and destruction of our current society, has a chance, has a real chance of delivering a lifestyle that is satisfying and allows everyone to have what they need in life, including a satisfying job and a satisfying creative life. So yeah, that's pretty interesting stuff. So let's actually see if we have another caller on the line. I guess I have to tell Charnchi that he can call back in if he wants, but he's working right now, so maybe you shouldn't bother him. Okay, let's see who's on the line here. Hello?
All right. You got me? You got me, buddy? You hear me?
Yes, who is this?
You hear me? Oh, yeah, man. What's up, brother? How's the time? Yeah, you hear me?
I can hear you.
You hear me?
Yes.
All right, man. Here, man. Now, we understand you're I understand you're a conspiracy theorist, and I'm going to recount all the... And disagree with me what I'm saying. You're saying the Vindenbergs, the Bilderberg Group, the Carlyles Group, the Rothschilds, Freemasons, Skulls and Bones, 14th Amendment, Jekyll Island, Bohemian Grove.
Actually, excuse me, sir.
You're saying the Federal Reserve, and you're saying...
Anyway, that was someone who didn't want to really converse, who just wanted to spout all this straw man... because we do not believe in conspiracies. In fact, that's the difference, main difference between us and some of the Alex Jones nuts. They are all about conspiracy theories. We offer an institutional analysis. Anarchism is known for its institutional analysis. And there's a very good article about this, actually, on ZNet by Michael Albert, where he talks about the difference between an institutional analysis and a conspiracy theory analysis. Now, that's not to say that there are not conspiracies in the world, but the root causes, the root causes is what we usually pay attention to as anarchists, That's why we, you know, we're called radicals, because we try to get at the root causes and not just focus on 9/11 or the Kennedy assassination or the Bilbergs or Hilbergs, whatever it is, the Rockefellers. These are part of the capitalist class. The Rockefellers, these guys, we don't focus on them as some sort of evil, you know, conspiracy. We see a logical, you know, mode of behavior coming out of the capitalist class, and that has to do with the with their, you know, with their interests. They have interests that are opposite to those of the working class, and of course they try to control the media, control the government, control every aspect of our lives to make sure that we don't challenge that power. So that's the way we actually see this whole thing. So I'm actually going to play a little clip, since the caller insisted that this was a conspiracy theory channel, to show him the kind of institutional analysis that we're talking about. I'll describe something very simple, which is the electoral system. This is going to be Thomas Ferguson, and I encourage you to actually see this documentary. It's called Golden Rule, The Investment Theory of Politics. So I'm going to play a little excerpt in which he explains the investment theory in a nutshell. So here it goes. Okay.
The classical theories of democracy way underestimate the costs facing ordinary voters as they actually try to control the state. You got to find out what it's doing. You got to sort through all the people telling you what your preferences are. And then you got to try to push it across in voting. And then you got to monitor what they actually do, if they live up in effect to their campaign promises. And if they don't, you then have to do something to force them back on the course. It's that last stage that's the hardest. You know, I mean, that is to say, if the candidate doesn't do what you say, what exactly do you do? Well, try to get them next election? Maybe. Okay, so if ordinary voters can't easily afford those costs, typically, then who can? The answer is rich people, businesses. Take a situation where everybody, by hypothesis, knows that the whole population, except for the business guys themselves, want unionization. But if it costs, say, $1,000 to campaign, and that's way beyond everybody's income, the ability to raise it, it doesn't matter how many people want it or that everybody knows already that people, if you come out to them, they'll get it. It's that you can't reach anybody with the appeal because you can't raise the money. To this day, despite all the noise about small countries, and particularly on the Obama campaign, which made a big pitch that they were small contribution driven, we now know they were not. So they were encouraging their people to break their contributions into small bits, often $200, and contribute over and over. And the studies that initially started reporting about how they were small contributor driven, I know the data sources that they work on. Neither they nor the data sources have good enough matching programs to enable you to get the same person more than once unless everything is matched. That is to say, you know, the junior, the address, you change a middle initial and stuff like that, you won't typically catch it. And so they just miss the repeated contributions by the same folks. They keep recording them as multiple contributions.
And Obama did organize a large number of people and many enthusiastic people, what's called in the press Obama's army. But the army is supposed to take instructions, not to implement, to introduce, develop programs and call on its own candidate to implement them.
You know, typically not less than 25% to 60% of your contributions are going to come in from people over $500 and often over $1,000. You could think of a modern campaign like modern war as effectively the equivalent of shooting a dealer display floor full of Mercedes Benzes at somebody. That's a lot of dough. So you need to keep refilling with Mercedes Benzes. And that's hard to do on small contributions. And the other side of it is the two critical points are is the voice is different between a few contributors and lots, and there is no easy follow-up. That's the really critical thing. that, I mean, for instance, you can give, a bunch of us can all, you know, lots of people contributed to Obama. I know a lot of people who did. When they start to do things like, you know, appoint, as they did, a former lobbyist for Goldman Sachs as Treasury Secretary's Chief of Staff, there's nobody who can come in and say, hey, you know, this is way wrong. But it happens in much party competition in most industrial states and pre-industrial states, for that matter, most of the time. That is, unless the population is actually organized in a fashion that allows them to sort of do this cheaply and easily. Then power is going to pass by default to blocks of investors. And they're effectively going to compete to control the state. So what you need is an analysis of competition within the business community. Now, this is competition with some real limits. I mean, it's like, it's not as though business communities compete to put themselves out of business. They don't offer higher and higher taxes on themselves. They don't offer medical care at their expense, and none of them offer unionization.
So that was Thomas Ferguson basically offering an institutional analysis of the of our electoral system. So nothing to do with some secret conspiracy trying to maneuver to control the world or anything like that. It's very straightforward, very clear. I wonder, is this the same caller still? Excuse me, are you the same caller as before, sir? Hello, who is this?
We saw the text box. This is Snake from SkypeAssholes.com. Can I introduce myself, please? We run a high-tech conference room at SkypeAssholes.com. More than welcome to join one of our conversations anytime you want. We run 24/7 all over the world. All right?
Well, I'm sorry that this is not a place to promote one show. If you actually want to ask something, you're free to do so. But, you know, how would you feel if I actually went to your show and started promoting my own stuff? It's not very nice, is it? All right. So we have another caller. Who is this?
This is David from Vancouver again.
Hey, Dave. How you feel?
Hello. Hey.
Yeah, we had a funny caller there.
That was amazing. That was amazing. The board is all lit up because everybody's like, I hope people don't think anarchists are, by definition, truthers. But I would have to say that that is definitely prevalent.
Well,
the connotation made.
It's funny because I have a liberal friend, and I'm telling you, for the past few years, he's done nothing but hammer me with this 911 truth stuff and how it's the most important thing in the universe. And of course, he says Chomsky sold his linguistics to the military and the military used it to kill thousands of people and all this garbage, you know. But what are you going to do, you know?
It's really effective killing people with generative grammar. It's actually the most effective weapon to kill people.
It's really
unknown.
But he says, oh, he's a linguist. They use his linguistics to use for mind control and torture and all this stuff. I was like, okay, I see.
Yeah, the one interesting thing I think about conspiracy theorists, or at least let's say you don't believe wholeheartedly in conspiracy theorists or theories,
yeah.
But you look upon it, that's more credible, I think, than someone who's providing institutional analysis. Because I think Chomsky himself, we're calling back to him, says if you just say something like all property is theft or the government represents incredibly tiny interests or something like that, that's far more profound and direct on someone's life. So they may have a more instant, visceral response against it and say, no, that can't be true. That's not the way the system works. Whereas if you say magic cards are real, like I can perform a magic trick or like be Chris Angel and fly or something like, you know, it's all it's alien conspiracies or something, people might be more willing to accept those really far out things. Like if these are people on the periphery, not people. Yeah, I'd say the conspiracy theories offer a real sort of easier to believe thing simply because they provide so little evidence. There's no argument to be made but for the surface.
Right.
People can go on about it.
And there's some middle of the road levels of conspiracy as well. Like, for example, you have a lot of people who say that all our economic problems have nothing to do with capitalism, have nothing to do with the financial sector. It's all the Federal Reserve, you know. And in fact, Ron Paul just bought this. You know, Ron Paul is not considered to be like Alex Jones. He's more more respectable, right? But he wrote this book called "End the Fed" and saying, you know, all the wars happened because of the Fed. The crisis happened because of the Fed, and you find scapegoats. So it may be the Hilbergs, it may be the Rockefellers, it may be, and it's a way of not actually saying, not focusing on the institutions and saying it's a few bad apples here and there, and if we just got rid of those, then we wouldn't have these problems.
You know, one thing that I find interesting about that, I haven't done a study or anything, but I find the Fed is the new Jew. So where an incredibly racist person could rail against the Jewish people and being these controlling, manipulative people behind the scenes, well, now you can't say that anymore. So it's the Fed, you know?
Right.
It's just like... The slander is exactly the same. Like the words were word for word verbatim, but instead you point it at the Fed, and then you slyly on your website or what have you point out that, oh, look at how many Israeli citizens there are in the American government. See what I'm saying? I noticed that. I mean, I'm not saying every single conspiracy theorist is a Zionist or whatever. I mean, truly anti-Semitic. That's the word I was thinking. But there does seem to be that thread, which is sort of disturbing when you eventually find it. Another guy's Len Horowitz. He was formerly a Jew, and then he became a rebirthed Christian, whatever that's called, born again Christian, he now rails against Judaism in his lectures. He's the guy that came up with injections, measles shots, give your children autism, and a host of other conspiracy theories. But
it
seem to be a very common thread.
Right. In fact, it doesn't have to be, like this friend, this liberal friend of mine who always talks about 911. Sometimes when he talks about it, he says, well, you know, some people say that the Jews knew about it, and the Mossad knew about it, and of course there was this guy who benefited, this Jewish owner of this building that got all the insurance money from the. All these things basically based on conspiracies, and I think they undermine even legitimate criticism of Israeli policies, because rather than looking at what's going on with the takeover of land from the Palestinians, war crimes, U.S. support for it. No, we end up talking about little, bad apples here and there and conspiracies, and it's not, in fact, I looked on YouTube Alex Jones' film received millions of hits. The Obama Deception, have you actually seen that one?
No, I haven't.
Yeah, it talks about how, he's part of a conspiracy to institute a world government, and he's backed by all these bankers, the Rockefeller, the Hilberg, I mean, all this stuff.
It's all very, very fun, but what's interesting is the caller who was hilarious, who just went on, his perception was that we... as anarchists have generally accept these beliefs, whereas it actually seems to be the kind of a liberal end of the spectrum and extreme right that hold these beliefs most close and internalize them the most. I find that most anarchists I talk to just kind of laugh at 9/11 conspiracy theories. However, there definitely is a very obvious, there's a common misperception. Well, anyways, I'm going to let you go because there's someone coming up.
Okay. Well, thanks for calling, man. All right. Nope. So that was Dave, and I guess we have another caller here whose name is Empire 161. Hello there? Somebody there?
Hi. You can speak.
I can't hear you very well. Are you connected on the internet? Hello? I think you have kind of a bad connection, so if you want to check out your cable or something and call later if you want. So I guess we're going to play a song here as a break, and we'll be back for the remainder of the show. So Why Do We Go to War by Sergeant Max, recorded live by Charnchi. He recorded it at some club. So enjoy Why Do We Go to War.
Accidents happen that take friends' lives. Disease, cuts, people down. We improve on safety if we put the search through. But there's one thing that we just ignore. Why do we go to war? 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 Thou shalt not kill. Thou shalt not kill. Thou shalt not kill anymore.
Sergeant Max, everyone, Why Do We Go to War? An excellent song. So I guess we can test once again if the caller has improved his connection. Empire 161, are you there? I'm afraid your connection is still not very good. Maybe you ought to call with the regular landline. Those tend to work a little bit more reliably. Anyway, so let's go on to some other news. You know, we always talk about the daily slaughter in the Middle East, and there was just another killing. U.S. forces, in conjunction with their Afghan puppets, has killed another child. And, yeah, let me see if I can actually open this window here. Yeah, I don't know what the circumstances were, but this happens all the time. Says the U.S. military says, of course, that's their, they take it from their point of view. They killed a child during a raid, says civilian deaths threatened to undermine Afghan support for international forces. That's all they care about. It's like, oh, you know, what are the consequences for us, you know, for the legitimacy of our occupation? I mean, that's the point of view right there. It's so obvious that the assumptions are all skewed. No, the real question is, you know, what about these people? What about their wishes? They, for years now, the people in Afghanistan have expressed they want the United States to get out. They don't want to be occupied. So the whole framework of this is just so skewed that is, you know, it really makes you angry, because if we were getting slaughtered like that, you know, it, we wouldn't stand for it. So apparently Obama is getting so desperate in with the Afghanistan war that now he's actually open to talk to the Taliban. There's a new story here talking about that. You know, they're really desperate, and you gotta fight a guns and butter war, because you can't expect to win it militarily unless they want, of course, drop a few nuclear bombs and kill everyone, which is not not to their interest. So so we have of course we have a new somebody's calling there. Anyway, we have a new article showing the Pentagon budget, and it's simply enormous. It's over $600 billion, and yeah, it's I think the largest military budget in history. And God, somebody's leaving a message in my answering machine. What a pain in the neck. Anyway, so let's continue with what I was saying. It says Israeli foreign minister says the peace deal is impossible. Well, what, you know, do we have any sort of like real news here? We know that for the past 30, 40 years, the Israelis and the United States have made peace impossible by virtue of their oppression of the Palestinians and their unending creation of new settlements. So, so that doesn't seem to me to be all that many new stories, but yeah, it's pretty heartbreaking, really. So anyway, you guys have any questions on the, in the chat room? You wanna, you have anything that you wanna talk about? Somebody is mentioning somebody's mentioning here party activism. You know, is it worth it to get involved with the party? Well, you know, I don't know. I think even people like Chomsky have said that if a third party got to power, you know, that would be an improvement over what we have now. You know, like a Green Party, maybe you get a little more healthcare, you get a little more you know, less oppression from the corporate class. Yes, that would be an improvement, but you know, real revolution, real improvement, including these third parties. The reason why they come about is because of a popular movement. I mean, that's sort of a standard story, that change doesn't come from above, it comes from below, right? So once you have some activists struggling for their rights and pressuring the status quo, then the elite are forced to bring about a new set of rulers who will be more in tune with some of the wishes of the population. Of course, one of the main functions of this is to appease the masses. So, you know, the reason why some of these more social democratic historical periods have come about is precisely because you had a very, maybe not very strong, but at least significant labor movement and other movements, like a women's movement and activist movement. And in order to appease those movements, you had to throw them some crumbs. You see, that's how it's not that the elite gave it to you out of the goodness of their hearts. And they may allow somebody in to office that, you know, they personally want to help people, but it's not about the individuals, it's about the institutions. So the government, people like Roosevelt, I mean, this is the one thing that I haven't seen Michael Moore's film, but he talks about how Roosevelt wanted to institute this new law where everyone would have the right to a decent job and everyone would have all these rights. And, you know, the thing is that even if you had Jesus Christ in office, and I don't mean to say Roosevelt was a saint by any means. In fact, I mean, he did you know, he in fact supported some of the fascist movements in Europe. But even if you were going to have a total saint in office, you know, would he be defined more by what he is as a person or by his institutional role? That's what we need to ask ourselves. And the answer to that is very straightforward. It is the institutions that that set the restrictions on how a person can behave. I mean, it's like saying, okay, I'm an anarchist, right? But I go to work for Starbucks. You know, okay, so you look at me. Okay, what am I doing in Starbucks that you could call anarchist? No, I'm. It's my job. You know, my job is to serve a latte. My job is to maximize profit for the people who work at who own the company. Now, I may be able to do a little bit, like maybe I get unionized. Maybe I'm able to get paid a little bit more and you know, take away from some of the profit, some of the exploitation of the owners. But let's face it, I'm not defined by what I think about myself or about the kind of world that I would like to see. I'm defined by what I'm doing right there and then, and I'm a damn wage slave. Okay, that's what you are, you know, when you work for a place like this, when you work in the capitalist system. So similarly, when you talk about a U.S. president, first of all, the chances are this as president, in order to get ahead in the structure, you have to internalize a lot of the values that are serviceable to the powerful anyway. You know, that's how they're not going to allow some guy that is a radical. They'll allow somebody who has radical rhetoric, maybe, but you know, who is under, you know, to appease the masses, but who will then do something else. I mean, Obama had all this rhetoric about hope and, you know, healthcare, universal healthcare and all this stuff, or at least a public option. But that's not clear it can come through either. And that's not to say that's very radical to begin with, but. So we have, on the one hand, the filter, the ideological filter, to anyone who wants to get ahead in the hierarchy, and number two, the constraints of the institution. So that's what we have to have in mind when we talk about the government and the corporations. That's basically the institutional analysis that we were talking about earlier. Not a conspiracy theory. Not some evil demon is trying to take over Starbucks. No. The reason why Starbucks is run the way it does, the way it is because, you know, you have it's a corporation, and the corporations are structured in the way that was described in the movie The Corporation. In the movie The Corporation, they explain very well the corporations have many of the traits of psychopaths. They don't have they don't act as regular sentient human beings. They have other, and that's why if you look at the collective behavior of these entities, it's monstrous, and that's in fact one of the strengths, I think, of left-leaning analysis, that we look at collective structures, we look at ourselves collectively. And we understand that the collective consciousness has a very strong effect on our individual behavior. And a lot of these so-called free market anarchists, who I always argue are not really anarchists, they somehow ignore the collective dynamics of capitalism. The fact that you have a class system made up not of you know, simply a government that somehow imposes a class. No, the capitalism itself is a class system. This is not, you know, they claim it's the government that's doing it, and without the government, capitalism would be a classless system. No, the owners naturally gravitate toward each other because they have common interest, and they're fewer than the proletariat, fewer than the workers, so therefore they have an easier time getting together. You have five owners and 500 workers, it's much easier for the five owners to get together and say, you know, how are we going to control these workers, than it is for the 500 workers to get together, at least in our society, where you have so many ways of getting distracted, so many ways of being manipulated, so many ways being subject to the ideological hegemony of the society. So that's the sort of paradigm that we have. So we have, somebody was mentioning Hobbes, of course, the philosopher who talked about the war of all against all. Well, I mean, you know, that's just been refuted by a lot of literature and a lot of anthropological discoveries that show that we're not like that. Back in 1902, Peter Kropotkin published the book Mutual Aid, which spoke about how mutual aid is there precisely because it's a very important factor in evolution. We got to help each other to survive. It's not just it's not simply the so-called Darwinian fight for survival. The Darwinian struggle for survival is also an endeavor of mutual aid, and very often going beyond even simply helping your species. Many species help other species, and I tend to agree with some of the more Marxian theories of the economic system being a very strong influence on the way we see the world, on the way that other aspects of culture develop. I don't think there's any doubt that that's a very strong factor. It's not the only factor. There's, of course, other factors having to do with, our dominion of nature. You know, what are the psychological difference between living as a hunter-gatherer who does not control nature except in ways that allow you to survive, such as, you know, hunting or cutting off a plant or whatever it is, with someone who controls nature. So that's another thing that we need to consider, and, you know, patriarchy and other things that developed later. I don't know about symbolic culture. I'm sort of not sure about what that, to what extent that is considered oppressive by people like John Zierson, who claimed that all symbolic culture is oppressive. I don't quite agree with that, but I do certainly see a lot of potential for symbols to be used to control us. But we use symbols to fight against the system. That's what this radio show is. That's what movies are. And but, you know, I do think there's some truth to the notion that we should try to not objectify life and not try to live life through all these mediations. We should try to have direct relationships, try to just not be mediated by all these constructs that we unfortunately have in place. But some of us think that some of these technological advances actually have a positive side that we should not dismiss. So that's a sort of a central incompatibility between the primitivists and the syndicalists. But I think we can still work on a lot of common issues. And I'm a big advocate of working on common issues with liberals, with communists, with socialists, with everybody. So, I guess with on that note, I'm gonna
90 seconds.
I'm gonna say goodbye. I actually have a screening of my documentary at an anarchist bookstore on a street called Haight Street here in San Francisco. So I have to hit down there in about half an hour. So I'm gonna leave you all guys with a song. I guess Bella Ciao. That should be a good one.
The world is waking outside my window. Oh, Bella Ciao, Bella Ciao, Bella Ciao, 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 it drives my senses. This dear sunlight, for there are things that I must. So wish me luck now.
10 seconds.
Drag me in.